Shrink Wrap Radio number 558, Embracing Your Lovability and Your Life with Dr. Kelly Flanagan.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Kelly Flanagan, clinical psychologist and author of the 2017 book, Lovable, Embracing What is Truest About You So You Can Truly Embrace Your Life. For more information about Dr. Kelly Flanagan, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Kelly Flanagan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show, particularly after spending a good deal of time with your book, which I want to congratulate you on your newly released first book, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Titled Lovable, Embracing What is Truest About You So That You Can Embrace Your Life. What led you to write this book?
Well, gosh, you know, I think there's sort of a long and winding process to get into the point of writing my first book. I have been a clinical psychologist in practice by 2012 for about 7 years.
Okay.
And at that point, I found myself looking for new creative ways to make my presence known in the community and sort of get my name out there. And I'd always been intrigued by the idea of writing. So I thought, you know, this blogging thing and content marketing is becoming a thing. What if I started a blog and marketed myself that way? And so I did. I sort of leapt in without really knowing what I was doing. And I wrote one blog post and I discovered immediately, or I remembered, I guess I should say, immediately that I love writing. And so I wrote a blog post for week two. And then week three, and so my blog began to grow. And about
boy, has it ever! That was one of the things that really impressed me. I took a look at it, and you had more than 59,000 followers, as I recall.
Yeah, that's a combination of email followers and social media followers. I think about 9 weeks in, I started to post every week. I thought it'd be sort of fun to be like a therapist and post to the same hour every week, and this would be sort of a therapeutic space for people to come to.
Wow.
And about 9 weeks in, I wrote a blog post called "Marriages for Losers," and that one received a lot of traction in social media. The concept was that in a marriage where both people have kind of committed to losing or sacrificing the ego essentially in order to be with each other, then that's what marriage is all about. And so that got a lot of traction, but it was really about 15 months in, I had an experience that led to me, and I write about this in Lovable, led to me writing a letter to my daughter, not intending to publish it on my blog. She was three at the time. This is April of 2013. And I read it to my wife and she said, I think you should, you know, she got very emotional and said, I think you should put that on your blog. I think a lot of people need to hear that. And I did. And that's when my blog really took off. And a subsequent letter to my daughter that I'd written from the makeup aisle about her inner beauty received so much attention that she and I ended up on the Today Show. And that was a surreal experience. We all went to New York together and we went to 30 Rock and it was a blast. And so, you know, when you start to get that kind of attention, you attract the attention of publishers and agents. And so I connected with an agent who's fantastic. And she said, you know, you're writing all these letters to your kids. You should maybe write a book on parenting. That seems to be what people are resonating with. And I went home and I told my wife, who's a child psychologist, by the way, that I was being suggested to write a book on parenting. And she said, dude, you got no business writing a book on parenting.
Really? Support.
You're not the parenting expert. And she was right. And what we started to decipher is we started to think through, well, then why, if you're not a parenting expert, why are people responding to these letters? And what we realized was that we were hearing back from people. We were hearing some, oh, I'm going to save this letter and give it to my daughter when she's 13. But what we were hearing a lot of was, I needed to hear this. I needed these words from grown-up people. And this awareness started to dawn on me that the letters I was writing to my kids were being received by the little kid in every reader, even if they were adults. The little kids who still needed to hear these things. Yeah.
And if I were to characterize the strength of your blog as to the extent that I've experienced it and the book, it's the quality of heart. And
Thank you.
There's a real strong heart.
Thank you.
That comes through. That's very compelling, I think.
That is honestly, I think, one of the kindest affirmations I could receive of my writing. It's actually, those are the exact words I use when I resonate with a piece of art or a television show, a movie. I often find myself saying it's got heart. And so thank you for that. And I try to write with that consistently. And if I'm not writing with that, I try not to put it out there. So that's the heart from which the book arose. Was I want to write a book that is a letter to my children in a way, like an extended love letter, but also a letter to the little kid in me who's still needing to hear all these things, and the little kid in every reader.
Well, speaking of that, the book is about lovability. Has embracing your own lovability been a challenge in your own life?
Yes, and. You know, this is an interesting balancing act that I walk as a therapist, because traditionally as therapists, we don't disclose a lot. We don't, we don't talk a lot about our own personal struggles, particularly to our clients. And one thing that has evolved for me as I've written the blog over the years is the discovery that when my clients happen upon it, almost inevitably, it has a positive effect on the therapy. Mm-hmm. They come in and say things like, I would have never told you this, but now that I know that you struggle with this too, I wanted you to know. So I'm, most of what I share in Lovable is about my own struggle with shame, and with trying to embrace and rediscover my true self, and then wrestling through the false self that I'd built up all those years. I didn't think I was good enough, and thinking that I needed to put another persona out there into the world. So what I usually say is, oftentimes my discussions with my clients generate the ideas for what I want to say, but if I can't find a reference point for it in my own experience, I don't usually write about it. Mm-hmm. I'm writing as much from a personal perspective as a professional. A lot of that comes through in the book.
Yeah, it does. And that's my favorite kind of writing. So,
Thanks.
You know, it's kind of, I've always been biased, you know, as a therapist, I guess, towards the personal, you know, that's
right.
That's what's interesting. And right. Yeah, your book gets off to a great start talking about a typo that you made on Google that led to the love letter that you're referring to, or at least one of them that you wrote to your daughter Caitlin when she was just 3 years old. Tell us that story about the typo on Google. I thought that was
fun. Yeah, that was that very first letter when my blog was still relatively small. And we'd had a coffee pot for years, probably left over from graduate school, and it finally went kaput. And so we ordered a new coffee pot from Amazon, and it was this fancy coffee pot, didn't have a heating pad, and we couldn't get the coffee in it to stay warm or to become warm. And so I went to Google and I meant to type in how to keep coffee hot in whatever the model of coffee pot it was. And I accidentally typed how to keep, and I started to spell hot, how to keep H, and Google auto-completed the search, how to keep him interested. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I clicked on it, and what came up was this wealth of articles and literature on the internet, mostly written by women, about how to keep a man interested in a woman. And the articles were mostly about how to stroke a man's ego, how to keep him feeling superior, really in a way sort of how to mother him rather than treat him as a companion who is on equal footing. I found it really disturbing thinking of my daughter, 3 years old now, but in 20 years, going to the internet and searching how to keep him interested, and being in a relationship where she was having to ask that question. So that's when I wrote this article. It kind of sprung from me, and letter. And the letter was to Caitlin, knowing that she wouldn't be able to read it, but that she would read it years from now, and emphasizing that if she can retain a sense of her true self and her worthiness, then relationships aren't about trying to earn interest from others. Relationships are about revealing who we are and sort of getting to see who shows interest.
Yeah, that letter went viral, and that's when your blog really took off, and ultimately you end up on the Today Show. I actually wanted to invite you to read that letter and maybe one or two of the others as we go along. Would that be okay?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
You did publish it in your book.
I did, and I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Would you like me to do that now?
Yeah.
Sure. I actually have a copy of Lovable here. The question is, where in the book is it? So I have three main sections in the book, and each starts with a letter to my kids.
I think it's the first letter. I'm not sure.
Okay, here it is. So it's originally titled A Daddy's Letter to His Little Girl About Her Future Husband. Dear Cutie Pie, recently your mother and I were searching for an answer on Google. Halfway through entering the question, Google returned a list of the most popular searches in the world. Perched at the top of the list was how to keep him interested. It startled me. I scanned several of the countless articles about how to be sexy and sexual and when to bring him a beer versus a sandwich and the ways to make him feel smart and superior. And I got angry. Little one, it is not, never has been, and never will be your job to keep him interested. Little one, your only task is to know deeply in your soul, in that unshakable place that isn't rattled by rejection and loss and ego, that you are worthy of interest. If you can remember that everyone else is worthy of interest also, the battle of your life will be mostly won. Remember, relationships aren't about proving your worth. They're about revealing your worth and thus finding the people who see your worth. If you can trust your worth in this way, you will be attractive in the most important sense of the word. You will attract a boy who is both capable of interest and who wants to spend his one life investing his interest in you. Little one, I want to tell you about the boy who doesn't need to be kept interested because he knows you are interesting. I don't care if he puts his elbows on the dinner table as long as he puts his eyes on the way your nose scrunches when you smile and then can't stop looking. I don't care if he can't play a bit of golf with me, as long as he can play with the children you give him and revel in all the glorious and frustrating ways they are just like you. I don't care if he doesn't follow his wallet, as long as he follows his heart and it always leads him back to you. I don't care if he is strong, as long as he gives you the space to exercise the strength that is in your heart. I couldn't care less how he votes, as long as he wakes up every morning and daily elects you to a place of honor in your home and a place of reverence in his heart. I don't care about the color of his skin, as long as he paints the canvas of your lives with brushstrokes of patience and sacrifice and vulnerability and tenderness. I don't care where he was raised, as long as he was raised to value the sacred and to know every moment of life and every moment of life with you is deeply sacred. In the end, little one, if you stumble across a boy like that and he and I have nothing else in common, we will have the most important thing in common, you. Because in the end, little one, the only thing you should have to do to keep him interested is to be you. Your eternally interested guy, Daddy.
Mm. Wow, that is so touching. Yeah, that is so touching and so moving.
Thanks.
At what age do you plan to give her this letter? You must have thought about that.
Well, my Caitlin doesn't need any encouragement to be thinking about boys.
Really? How old is she now? Goodness. How old is she now?
She is. She'll be 8 this September. And she, you know, from the moment she saw the first princess kiss the first prince in a Disney movie, she has been starstruck by the idea of dating. So I'm a little terrified.
Yeah, but as well, you should be.
I think, we tell our kids for the most part that dating is wonderful, but it narrows your experience dramatically. And so until you're ready to have your experience narrowed and to miss out on parts of various friendships and so on, maybe hold off on it. When it looks like she's done holding off on it, I think that's when I'll give it to her.
All right. I'll need to check in with you in about 10 years.
Right, yes.
To hear how it's going.
My guess is it'll probably be closer to about 6 or 7 years. So.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, it's all moving so rapidly.
That's right.
In this this letter to her, you said something about relationships, and you've got a portion in your book where you talk about the search for healing in our relationships. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, this is really at the crux of Lovable, because one of the things that I've realized over time as a therapist is I tend to think my clients are coming in, and broadly speaking, they're asking for, usually their relationships aren't going well, or they have some loss of a sense of direction or meaning in their lives. And those are the two most common presenting issues. And when I, for years, when I tried to dive in and work directly on those issues, we tended to get stuck. And what I discovered over time is that essentially the temptation is that the foundation of our lives is built on a sense of worthiness. And what we do when we begin to lose that sense of worthiness as a child, once we encounter shame, is we then say, okay, what's inside of me isn't good enough, essentially the definition of shame. And so now I need to go outside of me and look for something that will make me feel good enough. And one of the first places that we look is relationships. It's natural. Everyone does it. And then we also look to our accomplishments or our life direction or purpose. So we put this enormous burden on our relationships and on our sort of day-to-day sense of calling and purpose to make us feel good enough, when in fact things outside of us can't do that. And so this is where I see so much conflict and strife in relationships. I did it to my wife for years. You know, I didn't feel good enough, and I thought she was supposed to be the one who was going to make me finally feel lovable. And it was, and ironically, it was never good enough. She was never able to do enough to make me feel that way. And it wasn't until I embraced that it was my responsibility to reclaim my sense of worthiness that our relationship began to have some peace. And and so that's where I'm, what I'm trying to communicate with that is that the temptation is to say, you have to make me feel lovable, when in reality, I'm the only one who can do that.
You know, not only is she a clinical psychologist, as you mentioned, as well yeah. as you are, but she also shares the same first name of Kelly.
She does, yes.
One has to wonder. You know, we look for ourselves in the other. You actually yes. went so far as to find a Kelly.
I fell in love with her 3 weeks into graduate school, about a month before I really found out about narcissism. and I'm going, oh no, I fell in love with somebody who's got my exact name. About me. It's spelled exactly the same way. We joke that she, shortly after we met, she wrote home to her mom and said, I met this great guy, but his name's Kelly, so it just can't work out. But we overcame that.
Yeah, what a story. That's great. And it's so good that you can laugh about it now.
Yeah.
So what we've been talking about so far is in a section of the book that you refer to as the backstory, in which you were sharing some of your backstory as you've been doing with us just now. And you say we all have a backstory. That resonates with me, but what are you getting at when you say that?
Yeah. One of the ways that I like to reframe therapy for clients is that usually when a client comes to therapy, they feel like they're at the end of their story. They feel like they've tried to figure it all out and nothing has worked, and now they're asking for extra help. And one of the ways that I reframe it is, you know, if your life was a movie, going to your therapist wouldn't be the last scene in your movie. It'd be near the beginning. You'd get about 5 or 10 minutes setting up your character and everything that you've been through and where you're needing to head. And then your character goes to therapy. And that's the inciting incident of the movie, where you begin to find out that this character is not going to go backwards. They're going to move forward. They're going to transform. They're going to redeem all of that backstory that has come before. And so I just try to reframe it for clients that therapy is very much the beginning of their story, not the end.
I love that.
Yeah, thanks. And so I wanted to do the same thing with the book, because usually when you come to a book called Lovable and you pick it up off the shelf, it means you're needing something and you're longing for something. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, 18 or 80, it's quite possible that all of the time that has come before that moment is backstory, and that this is really the opening scene in your story, the inciting incident that can move you forward. And so in the book, I describe the backstory as all of that time where we've been searching in our relationships and in our sense of purpose and calling for a sense of worth, and we've been looking in the wrong place. And so everything is backstory leading up to that point where we decide to begin to reclaim a sense of worth within us. And that's when our story really gets started.
Okay. And as you say, your book is founded on the foundation of it is worthiness. Yeah. So what does it mean to be worthy?
Yeah. I think one of the most important things about worthiness that is sort of counterintuitive. I get the question, well, I'll tell you a story that really anchored the book for me around this concept of worthiness. I get connected with this agent and she says, yeah, I've never written a book before. She says, send me a bunch of, send me ideas. So I keep sending her these ideas. And I remember it was a Friday night, I think. I'm standing in my kitchen and I get a text back from her that basically says, you keep talking about this worthiness thing and it's great work if you can get it, Doc, but how does a person become worthy? And I remember reading that to my wife and going, can you believe she would say that? You don't become worthy. You are worthy. Somewhere along the line, you forget it. And the task of life is remembering that you're worthy. And my wife looks at me, she goes, you might want to tell her that, that's what you think. And so I did. And she said, yeah, that resonates so deeply. It is something everybody needs to hear. I go back to my kids. I go back to my kids coming into the world and not for one second questioning their worthiness, and watching, for instance, my son, who didn't care that he wore, mismatched pants and mismatched shirt and two mismatched socks to school until about the third grade, right? Fourth grade, maybe, because his sense of worthiness wasn't connected to what he wore. It wasn't connected to what people thought of him. It was simply self-evident to him that he was worthy. And the problem is not that we lack worthiness, but that somewhere along the line, we begin to distrust it, that we encounter this message of shame that says you aren't good enough the way that you came into the world. And now we've got a project to do. We've got a project of hiding ourselves away and trying to build a better self to present to the world. And so much of reconnecting with our worthiness is about beginning to let go of that false self we've created and getting reconnected again with the little one that we once were, and to whom our worthiness was self-evident.
Yeah. Speaking of the little one, you say that there's a wounded little one in us all.
Yep. Yes. This concept of having a little kid in us who is both the epitome of our truest self, right? Mm-hmm. The way that we came into the world, but also the part of us that first experienced the wounding. Right? So this little one stands at the intersection of my worthiness is self-evident and someone is communicating to me or life is communicating to me that it's actually not, that I'm actually not worthy and I need to do something, please somebody, keep somebody calm, be better looking than some other person's kids, that there are conditions upon my worthiness. So that kid, both that little one inside of us, both holds the reality of our sense of worthiness and also the wound, at which point we began to believe that we weren't worthy.
Mm. So it's really paradoxical. I love the way that you present that both pieces are there.
Well, and it's the importance. I mean, when we have such old, ongoing wounds within us, our inclination is to stay away from them, to move away from them, to not feel them. And I think part, at least in terms of the feedback I'm getting about Lovable, is that the book actually helps the reader begin to move towards those early wounds and discover that in the midst of feeling them, the work is done already because they're feeling the wounds of the little kid inside of them, but that little kid inside of them also possesses their sense of worthiness. So both of those things happen almost simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just reflecting that I think the dynamic that you're talking about there is part of the human condition rather than blaming it on bad parenting or which some of the time one must, but
yes,
but probably nobody gets away from dealing with this paradox.
Well, absolutely not. And that's, I make that point in Lovable, even if you live a Cinderella story, right? Even if everything is just about as ideal as it can be, somewhere along the line, those doubts are going to start to creep in, and it might be as simple as, can you imagine if you get all the way to say being 13 years old and not encountering any shame or experiencing any, and then just again, walking into the magazine aisle of a, a women's magazine aisle and seeing all these depictions of how you're supposed to look if you want to get on the cover of a magazine and be desirable. And then you look down and you say, oh, I'm not that. I guess what I am is not good enough. So there's really no way to avoid that experience. And so it is, it's truly part of the human experience. And I know parents, when I start to talk about this, they start to worry, you know, what shame might I be communicating to my children? Could I possibly be doing that? And my answer is absolutely yes. I mean, we sort of pass these things along. We have conditions on our sense of worth. And so we naturally will pass some of those on to our kids. They weren't going to escape shame anyways. And so that's okay. But if you can begin to be aware of those things, then you'll find healing for yourself and you'll help your kids maintain a sense of connection to their own worthiness.
Yeah. Great advice. What are some of the misguided ways that we seek to heal our woundedness?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I go back to that idea that oftentimes our first experiences of shame happen in relationships. And so, the natural conclusion I think that we make is, well, relationships made me wonder if I was good enough. And so maybe it's relationships that will make me feel good enough again. And you see this in kids who start to try to appear like everybody else in school. You know, they all got to dress the same way. Everybody likes the same music. Maybe if I fit in, right, mm-hmm. I'll be good enough. Mm-hmm. Or the young girl who starts dating a boy who's on the baseball team, and all of a sudden she's a huge baseball fan, even though it bores her to death, right? So all of a sudden I'm becoming the people around me in order to find a sense of being good enough and to find a sense of belonging. So I think our relationships are a big place. I think we very, very many of us feel like we have to do something great. You know, do something that's more than enough to prove that we're good enough. So we're constantly striving to do more and prove more that we're worthy, whether that's in a career or raising kids who are very successful, or whatever that might be. You know, I come from a faith tradition where I remember coming out of my childhood feeling like if I didn't almost single-handedly save the world, then I had been a disappointment. So there's this huge pressure to be the game changer in the world to prove that we're good enough. Mm-hmm. And so I think those two main areas, our relationships and our accomplishments, are two places that we go to prove our worth.
Okay. Time for another letter.
Okay.
In your book, you wrote one titled A Daddy's Letter to His Little Girl About, no, that is the one you read, about her future husband.
Right.
Okay, not time for that one. I didn't realize I had that replication there.
Maybe the one from the makeup aisle?
Yeah. Let's do that one. I might reference that further on, but let's do that.
Okay. It seems, I mentioned that because it seemed, well, I mean, it was the one that had us ending up on the Today Show, but okay, I also say it because it is an article, or it is a letter that I wrote, and it's as much about being who she, letting what she does in her life be an expression of who she is rather than a way to prove that she's enough. So one of the ways I often say this is, what you do in the world, is best lived as an expression of your worthiness rather than as an attempt to prove your worthiness. And if it's lived as an attempt to prove your worthiness, you end up in burnout. You end up cynical and frustrated or more ashamed of yourself because you didn't accomplish what you wanted to. Mm. But if it's freely flowing from a sense of worthiness, then it is much more likely to bring you joy and fulfillment and so on. So this is about her inner beauty, but also encouraging her to live from that inner beauty. Words from a father to his daughter from the makeup aisle. Dear little one, as I write this, I'm sitting in the makeup aisle of our local Target store. A friend recently texted me from a different makeup aisle and told me it felt like one of the most oppressive places in the world. I wanted to find out what he meant. And now that I'm sitting here, I'm beginning to agree with him. Words have power, and the words on display in this aisle have a deep power. Words and phrases like affordably gorgeous, infallible, flawless finish, brilliant strength, liquid power, go nude, age defying, instant age rewind, choose your dream, nearly naked, and natural beauty. when you have a daughter, you start to realize she's as strong as everyone else in the house, a force to be reckoned with, a soul on fire with the same life and gifts and passions as any man. Huh. But sitting in this store aisle, you also begin to realize most people won't see her that way. They'll see her as a pretty face and a body to enjoy, and they'll tell her she has to look a certain way to have any worth or influence. But words do have power, and maybe, just maybe, the words of a father can begin to compete with the words of the world. Maybe a father's words can deliver his daughter through this gauntlet of institutionalized shame and into a deep, unshakable sense of her own worthiness and beauty. Little one, a father's words aren't different words, but they are words with a radically different meaning. Brilliant strength. May your strength be not in your fingernails, but in your heart. May you discern in your center who you are, and then may you fearfully but tenaciously live it out in the world. Choose your dream, but not from a department store shelf. Find the still, quiet place within you. A real dream has been planted there. Discover what you want to do in the world, and when you have chosen, may you faithfully pursue it with integrity and with hope. Naked. The world wants you to take your clothes off. Please keep them on, but take your gloves off. Pull no punches, say what is in your heart, be vulnerable, embrace risk, love a world that barely knows what it means to love itself. Do so nakedly, openly, with abandon. Infallible. May you be constantly infallibly aware that infallibility doesn't exist. It's an illusion created by people interested in your wallet. If you choose to seek perfection, may it be in an infallible grace for yourself and for everyone around you. Age-defying. Your skin will wrinkle and your youth will fade, but your soul is ageless. It will always know how to play and how to enjoy and how to revel in this one chance life. May you always defiantly resist the aging of your spirit. Flawless finish. Your finish has nothing to do with how your face looks today and everything to do with how your life looks on your last day. May your years be a preparation for that day. May you be aged by grace. May you grow in wisdom. May your love become big enough to embrace all people. And may your joy have no bottom. May your flawless finish be a peaceful embrace of the end and the unknown that follows, and may it thus be a gift to everyone who cherishes you. Little one, you love everything pink and frilly, and I will surely understand if someday makeup is important to you, but I pray three words will remain more important to you. The last three words you say every night when I ask the question, where are you the most beautiful? Three words so bright no concealer can cover them. Where are you the most beautiful? On the inside. Love, Daddy.
Mm. Yeah, that's another powerful, powerful letter.
Thank you.
Yeah, truly. I would say that your book is an inspirational book. And
thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what you set out to do, but if I was going to market it, that might be the way I would market it.
What I set out to do, my hope was that I would write a book that would be as much an experience as a read, so that when you finished it, you felt like you had about a year's worth of therapy. and so in that sense, inspirational, I hope, in the sense inspired to breathe new life into. And that is the feedback that I've been getting, is people say, I had to read this slowly because I needed to put it down after each chapter and digest it. And so I'm grateful to have been able to follow through on the vision of that.
Right. And part of the gift that you have there is you've got all these down-to-earth, day-to-day type stories that you've drawn from your own life, and you weave them into wisdom teaching tales, I would have to say. So yeah, it makes me wonder, you know, do you keep a journal? How are you coming up with all these little stories?
It's a great question. I use an Evernote app, and I keep a list of stories that I encounter. You know, so many of my blog posts, they start with a story that sort of hits me and I go, that's meaningful. I don't quite know why, but there was something meaningful in that. And then the writing of it becomes a meditation on what was going on in that. So I keep a list of stories that feel meaningful. I also keep a list of ideas that I think are interesting. And when a story syncs up with an idea, that's when a blog post or a chapter comes together really nicely. For me, it's, I guess one thing I've learned, and actually the last 3 months have been really hard on this, is that when I'm present to my life, the stories and the lessons present themselves, because I'm paying attention. But when I'm being ambitious, when I'm trying to come up with a blog post or trying to think about how to, you know, promote this or write mm-hmm. this, I'm not present to my life. And so I quit noticing the stories. So, for me, it's about being present, and my kids are a fountain of good stories.
Yeah.
My 13-year-old, I know I'm sure I'll write about this if he lets me. The other night he said, a friend said, "Hey, you're going to be in eighth grade next year. Most popular kids in the school, isn't that great?" And he said, he was like drinking a soda. He goes, "I'm never going to be the most popular kid in the school." He said, "There's going to be plenty of seventh graders more popular than me." And my friend said, "Oh, that's not true." And he goes, "No, it's okay. Being popular wouldn't make me happy anyways." You know, this wisdom of we're all looking for this thing that's going to solve this problem within us. Uh-huh. And for some of us, many of us, it's popularity. It's a crowd. And he's already going, "No, that's not going to solve the problem."
Yeah.
And so I notice I experience a story like that. And then I try to put it into words.
Geez, I have Evernote, but it's not doing that. It's not doing that for me.
It's just a note. Yeah, it's just a note.
I'll have to whip that Evernote into shape.
There you go.
So I'm struck by your self-awareness to kind of pause and look at your life at this point and realize that, if I'm hearing you correctly, that while all of this success and attention kind of can pull me off the dime a bit if I get too focused on that, and I need to stick with my own experience in the here and now.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things I talk about in Lovable that is, you know, as we begin to forget our sense or get disconnected from our sense of worthiness or our true self, we compensate by building a false self, and that's when our ego develops. And one of the things I talk about in Lovable is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion of overcoming your ego, getting rid of it, and my experience is not that anymore. It's that the ego is always there, just sort of waiting to be reawakened. and success has a way of reawakening the ego. The ego jumps out and attaches to it and says, "Well, that's where I'll get my identity. That's where I'll get, that'll solve all my problems if the success can continue to build on itself." And certainly I've had that temptation in numerous ways over the last few months. And it's a matter of waking up again to it again and observing it and saying, you know, there's no ultimate solution to being alive. And certainly the success of a book would probably create more problems than it would solve. And that's an illusion too. And so just not getting sucked into that, mm-hmm. that temptation.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I like it when you wrote, "You don't need to be more, you just need to be more you."
Yeah, that's getting back at that idea that when we're feeling ashamed, the sense is, "I'm not enough, so I need to be more." The awareness of that again happened. I bought a PBS sponsored t-shirt, and threw it on for, I went to a party, and it said "Be More" on the front. And I'm standing in the party, I was actually meeting people I hadn't met before, and I thought, "Oh my goodness, what a message to send to people. Be more, like you're not enough, be more," you know,
right.
and how there's this like inherent shame in that message. And so that line in the book arose out of that awareness of, no, that we're not here to be more and more and better. We're here to simply be clearer and clearer versions of who we already are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love the story that you tell about the Icelandic bus tour.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, yeah. Share it with our audience here.
Yeah. Well, because that, to me, that gets at the heart of this concept of rediscovering our worthiness and our true self. Yeah. I read this in the newspaper a while back. I've not been able to find the original article. It was an Icelandic bus tour, and they made a pit stop somewhere, and when they got on the bus to, I guess, do a head count or something, it was discovered that this woman had gone missing while they were on the rest stop. And so they kind of came together, came up with a description of the woman, issued the description to everybody, said, "Okay, let's go out and find her." They searched for a while. It wasn't till later that one of the women who was on the search party realized that she was searching for herself, that she had not recognized the description of herself. and they were able to call off the search. She was, "Oh, I'm the one we're all searching for." she'd never been missing in the first place. And that, yeah. and that to me gets at the heart of this idea of the true self, that we think it's gone missing, but it's never gone missing in the first place. We just don't recognize the description of it. And so increasingly embracing our worthiness is about recognizing the description of who we already are.
I'm the one I've been searching for.
I'm the one I've been searching for. That's right. One of my favorite spiritual writers introduced me to the concept, which is not his originally. A few of these concepts are any of ours originally, but that we are becoming who we already are. That, you know, becoming yourself isn't a construction project and making something out of nothing. Usually it's more like an excavation project and brushing away all the debris we've added over the years to get back to who we are essentially. And that who we are essentially is really, really good.
Okay. We've been talking about all of these very positive things here,
right?
But you address anger as well. And you say anger is the first breadcrumb as we search through the darkness to get out of our shame. So that's a little surprising. Oh, anger? How's that?
Talking about autobiographical, I found myself really stuck in my journey and trying to figure out who I was. And then actually the same buddy who texted me about the makeup aisle and the same friend who told me about your show originally, this is one of our first meetings together. And I was telling him about some stuff that was going on in my life. And he said, "You must be really angry." And I said, "No, I'm not angry." But that seed had been planted, and I started to realize all of the ways in which I was carrying around a lot of anger within me. And that became, for me, really the first breadcrumb on the path back to discovering who I was. And as over the years, that's what I've discovered, is that when a client feels stuck in therapy, and if a client feels stuck in terms of developing self-confidence and self-esteem, and you've never talked about their anger, then it's probably because you've never discovered the actual path back to their true self, and that the first breadcrumb on that path is their anger. Because what you realize is that that little kid that we talked about, who is aware of his or her own worthiness, but is also wounded, the first reaction to that wound is often anger. It's, "Wait a second. I don't deserve to be treated this way. Wait a sec, you know, this is not fair. This is unjust." And so that anger is often almost like a homing beacon for that little one within us. And so a question that I'll often ask is, when you get angry, how old do you feel?
Hmm.
You know, so and that can be a very quick way to say, "Well, I act and I feel about 6 years old when I'm angry. You know, I throw stuff. And so then we say, What happened when you were six? You know, what happened when that little one encountered shame? Because it sounds like you've got a little one in you who's about 6 years old and who's really wanting to defend him or herself." And this is one of the most reliable ways to reconnect with the little one. I get people all the time saying, "I don't have any sense of worthiness. There's nothing there." But then they'll tell me, "But I get angry when my husband doesn't treat me well." And I'll say, "But that's your sense of worthiness speaking. It's saying I'm worth being treated better." And so that can begin to be the pathway back to that sense of worthiness.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, obviously, anger is not something we want to cultivate, not something we want to nurture. And I should add that here, because I do add that in the book, that one of the things about anger that we've learned over time is that the expression of anger actually can increase anger. It doesn't. There's not a sense of catharsis that happens, but a sense of escalation.
Right.
But anger can be traded in for softer feelings when we begin to become aware of the softer feelings underlying our anger. And those feelings do diminish as they're expressed. Sadness does diminish as we cry and as we speak it out to other people. So as we become aware of our anger, it connects us with the little one in us who is aware of our worthiness. And it also gives us a chance to start to trade in that anger for the softer feelings that went along with being that little wounded kid. Mm-hmm. And those feelings can diminish.
You also write that the secret to being worthy is doing nothing. Now, that sounds very Zen. What are you getting at?
Yeah. Well, that's getting at a number of levels of this. But the first one that I would mention is that when we feel like we aren't enough, then we start to try to do things that are more than enough once again. And so a lot of our doing in life is an effort to prove that we're good enough. And so by simply not doing those things, we're beginning to reverse time a little bit and to return to that place where we're aware that being and who we are is good enough simply by virtue of being. So there is a Zen quality to that, as I've mentioned, being twice. But also that all of our doing fills up all of our space and time and leaves us no space for presence with ourselves. And again, this idea of reclaiming our worthiness is an inward journey. We keep trying to reclaim it through outward journeys towards people and towards achievements, but we have to make an inward journey. And if we're doing lots of things, then there's no space to simply be and to breathe and to get reacquainted with what we're feeling and to get reacquainted and to be able to listen into that voice of shame and discover the mantra that it's been repeating our whole lives. And so we have to eliminate a lot of our doing and create space for stillness and breathing and for contemplation.
Mm-hmm. It struck me as I was reading about lovability and so on, that the word lovable can refer to two things, worthy of receiving love, but also the ability to give love.
Yeah. Yes.
Was that in your mind at all while you were working on the book?
Yeah. I inserted in that first letter I read today, I inserted that line. And if you can remember that everyone else is also worthy of interest, the battle of your life will be mostly won. Mm-hmm. And a concept that I develop over the course of lovable is that as, there's a concern, I think when people hear this, boy, this sounds very self-centered. This is all this kind of touchy-feely, love yourself, become terribly selfish and take care of yourself. But the hallmark of getting reconnected with our true self is the ability to see the true self and the worthy self in everybody else. And when we do that, then loving other people becomes a much more natural, easily flowing experience. And so this work of getting reconnected with our true self also paves the way for being able to love each other well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's we could probably spend an hour on that idea.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. So many of these ideas. Loneliness is another topic that you take up, and you were just talking about the importance of being able to be alone and to get into one's still place. But loneliness is such a painful place to be. Where does that come into play in relation to lovability?
Yeah, yeah. Well. I think you said something earlier that shame is a part of being human. It's just going to be part of existence. We can't escape it. I think loneliness is the same way. But I think as young people, when we begin to experience loneliness, what we begin to do is we make attributions. So I'm lonely. There must be something wrong with me. Again, there must be something not good enough about me. So I'm going to build a false self that is going to go out into the world as my persona, as my representative. And that false self is going to earn the kind of connection and take away, be my representative, take away my loneliness. And there's a problem with that, because if it's our false self that is connecting with people, we know it's not who we really are that's connecting. So I think of it as our true self is sort of sitting inside the shell of our false self, lonelier than ever. And so the false self backfires and leaves us more lonely than ever. As we begin to embrace our worthiness and trust that our true self is worthy of relationship, worthy of being loved, worthy of belonging, then we can say, okay, false self, settle down. I'm going to send my true self out into the world. I'm going to reveal who I am. And I'm going to see who's excited about that, who's interested in that, and who responds. And relationships start to become a little less complicated.
Mm-hmm. You have a discussion of bullying in the book. And, that's something that I think many parents really struggle with, because there's the kid in school, they can't be there to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid is probably feeling a lot of shame.
Right.
Yeah. What's your advice to parents of a child who is being bullied in school?
I should call my wife in for this question. She's the bullying expert, and she had a lot of input into that chapter. So I'm going to channel her for a second.
Okay.
first, she would say your school should have a clear anti-bullying policy, and clear methods of enforcing it, and so in cooperation with your child, if your child is being bullied, then working with the school to begin to mediate that and eliminate that is important. So that's from a systems perspective. That's what my wife would say. And I think it's important. You know, I think sometimes we say to our kids, well, you just have to ignore them, or you just have to get over it, or you just have to, you know, oh, it's not true. And there's some truth to that, but there's also a systemic issue that bullying does need to be monitored and addressed in schools. In the context of lovable, what was the, it's the one sentence that will disarm any bully. I think that's the idea. The sentence that, again, I'm telling a story in the book, and I'm telling a story about my son being bullied, and I want to make sure I get it right. Let's see if I can find it really quickly.
I can probably prompt you with it from,
yeah, you,
from
yeah.
memory. Yeah. Something along the lines of, I really love myself. I'm sorry that you don't love yourself.
I think I try to make it, because it can be a way to hurt someone too, right?
Yeah.
Right. So there's a couple pieces to it. So there's one story I tell of bullying in which we talk about the idea of closing his lid, right? The idea that this was communicated by a teacher in a local school district. She said, some people will try to put good things into your bucket, and some people try to put bad things into your metaphorical bucket. And when people try to put bad things in, you just need to close your lid. And the kids instantly get it. They, you're trying to put bad things in my bucket. No, I'm not going to let you put that inside of me. I'm not going to absorb that. I'm going to go play with these people who are putting good things in my bucket. So there's that piece of handling bullying, which is de-escalating it through taking responsibility for our own emotional world. But then there is also that idea that I said to Aiden one day, I said, it was something along the lines of, I like myself. I can't quite recall it, but I think you kind of nailed that. Like, and you don't, and you're trying to pass that on to me, and I'm not going to receive it, basically. Yeah. And of course we didn't actually talk about him saying this to a bully, cause that's liable to get him popped in the nose. but what we're talking about is having it be a reality within him.
An inner thing that you're reminding yourself of.
Right? Yeah. Like this person is, most bullying comes out of a tremendous sense of shame that they're now trying to pass on to you. And if you don't let it be passed on, then you've done something pretty awesome there. And again, it's not always up to the child to close their bucket. It's not always only their responsibility to handle bullying. But there are some things we can teach our kids emotionally to deal with it.
Okay. Now, you mentioned your therapy practice a few times. I'd be interested to know a bit more about that. Are you in solo practice? Or are you work with an agency? What's the setup?
Yeah. I worked for a great group for about a decade. And then 2 years ago, in the midst of actually my wife and I making a life overhaul, she stepped down from a tenured professorship that she was in order to provide more direct service to kids, to underserved children. I discontinued my work with the counseling center where I was at, and I started my own practice with a friend of mine. And small practice. We have two employees now, and then plus the two of us. And then we moved our family out of the suburban setting that we were in, and we moved us back to a more rural setting that we thought would be a better fit for the pace of life that we were seeking, and for basically me splitting my time by coming back into the suburbs to practice here at my practice, and then spending the rest of the week out in the country writing. So that's what we're doing now.
Okay. And how would you describe your theoretical approach?
I was actually thinking about this morning while I was drinking my smoothie, because I knew I was coming on your show, and I appreciated your clarity in terms of theoretical issues. I'd say the therapeutic model and the theoretical model that has most resonated with me is object relations theory. And I think it's a psychodynamic approach to understanding people and to understanding relationships that boils down a lot of complexity into a manageable way that translates into to therapeutic interventions that have a positive impact. That's kind of at the core of how I think about people. the object relations approach. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, this this book Lovable comes out of me developing kind of harnessing mindfulness approaches, the object relations approach, you know, as well as some more existential therapeutic approaches, and harnessing them and bringing them together to say healing and health progress through these stages of developing a sense of worthiness, revealing ourselves to others to find a place of belonging, and then with the support of our people and the support of our place of belonging, launching ourselves into doing something we're passionate about in the world, regardless of how ordinary or extraordinary it might be. And so now I bring each of those different theoretical orientations to bear upon that progression from worthiness to belonging to purpose. So I'm immediately at the beginning of a therapy trying to ascertain, are you coming in telling me you need help with worthiness? Are you telling me that this is, I'm pretty confident in myself, but for some reason that's not translating into fulfilling relationships? Or are you telling me, no, I'm doing okay and I love my family, but I can't figure out where I want to go with my life? And so that's an orienting progression for me now as I think about a therapy.
You know, that could be a good wrap up, I think, for this interview.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So, Dr. Kelly Flanagan, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me. This was a fun conversation. I really appreciate it.
As you heard me remark in the interview, Dr. Flanagan has written a very inspirational book. It's especially so for parents, but I think readers of any age will find it moving, uplifting, and thought-provoking. I'm very impressed by Kelly Flanagan, the person, as I experienced him in both reading his book and in the interview. If I were looking for a therapist, I can easily imagine opening up to him and trusting him. I guess in large part this is due to his own willingness to be open and vulnerable. Beyond that, I'm impressed by his ability to express profound ideas in simple stories and to speak about issues of the human heart with such clarity. He writes beautifully. I can only wish I had written such beautiful letters to my own children when they were young. I think I do recall attempting something along those lines in my journal shortly after my first was born. But I think it was a lot about my own fears and insecurities around becoming a parent. Even though I didn't write such beautiful letters myself, I'm planning to recycle his letters to his children by sending them to my adult kids with the idea that they might want to share them with their own kids at some point, my grandkids, that is. I think they're that valuable. I also recommend his blog, which you can find on the homepage of his website at www.drkellyflanagan.com. And Dr. Kelly Flanagan is spelled drkellyflanagan.com. The title of the book again is Lovable, Embracing What Is Truest About You So That You Can Truly Embrace Your Life, by Dr. Kelly Flanagan. And, as usual, if you decide to order his book, I encourage you to use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our website.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Sabine. I'm studying integral and transpersonal psychology, and I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio podcast for a while. I have learned so much from the interviews and on so many topics. And I love particularly those interviews focus on Jungian and transpersonal psychology. Please keep going, Dr. Dave. You enrich our lives and our work so that we can transform others.
Wow, Sabina, what a voice. Thank you for your ongoing financial support and for encouraging others to follow your fine example. With your support and encouragement, I'll do my best to keep going in what you describe as a transformational process. And I'm happy to say we do have two new donors since the last episode, one being Sabina and the other Emma Stone. In the past, you've heard me say that I turned down many opportunities to do sponsored ads on this podcast. The entity that I feel best about advertising is Shrink Wrap Radio because I believe in what I'm doing and believe this work should be supported. However, I now want to take the opportunity to make an unpaid endorsement of a web design company that has been an invaluable resource in helping me keep our website up and running for a number of years now. I'm referring to Quan Web Studios. Steve Post heads up the team there, and they are a full-service digital marketing agency. Years ago, they converted my old HTML-based Shrink Wrap Radio website to the WordPress version you see today. In addition, Steve and his crew have helped me with a number of web challenges over these past years. I'd probably be out of business if it weren't for their expertise and generous help. Their pricing is more than fair, and they've always been extremely responsive. The website is www.quanwebstudios.com, and Quan is spelled Q-U-A-N. As I said at the beginning, this is an unpaid endorsement. I just wanted to do it out of gratitude for their support and also to turn you on to a good thing. Speaking of good things, I've received an invitation from Matthew Dolitz, the editor of the pioneering online periodical, The Neuropsychotherapist, to join him in a new publishing venture. If you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any time, you're probably aware of my strong interest in technology, both exciting and scary places it's taking us. Well, Matt is starting up a new online publication called Age of Robotics Magazine, and he asked me to head up the psychology section of that magazine. Here's the mission statement for the magazine. Age of Robots magazine reports on the technology of the second machine age and how it's impacting our society and psychology. Of particular interest are the issues around technology and work, how it's either enhancing our capacity to work or replacing human effort. We're also interested in a wide array of topics around robotics, AI, and future technology trends. We aim to provide interesting and entertaining reporting for the general public. Or maybe the magazine will be called Neuro Robotics Magazine. Here's the mission statement for that version. Neuro Robotics Magazine is devoted to informing multidisciplinary researchers, developers, manufacturers, and the general public about the science and technology of machine learning and embodied autonomous neural systems through digital publications, online communities, and real-world events. We focus on both biologically inspired algorithms and computational models, as well as actual neural networks. We report on advances in the embodiment of such neural systems in artificial software and hardware devices, machines, interfaces, robots, and the impact such systems are having on our lives. Our hope is that our magazine and community will inform and inspire anyone interested in the emerging fields of neuroscience, artificial intelligence, and robotics. So that was written by Matt, not by me. I have to give credit where credit is due. Many times in the past, you've heard me promote The Neuropsychotherapist here. It's an incredibly beautiful and informative magazine that Matt has put together. It's a real treasure trove of information about what's going on in neuroscience and the juncture with psychotherapy. It's been my pleasure to serve in an advisory capacity on that magazine, and I'm thrilled to be invited to be part of Matt's latest venture. I'll keep you up to date as things develop. I think you can get a bit of a sneak preview by going to www.neurorobotics.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Kelly Flanagan, clinical psychologist and author of the 2017 book, Lovable, Embracing What Is Truest About You So You Can Truly Embrace Your Life. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Well, of course, that was today's guest, Dr. Kelly Flanagan. Now let's dip into our listener email basket. First, we hear from Azriel, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for a development in my life that might be to your credit. We've discussed before the Jungian concept of synchronicity, and part of it revolved around the power of our minds to put out, quotes, positive energy into the universe, and then the universe might respond in kind. Parentheses, I personally view this through a theistic perspective, but this is a side point, close parentheses. I'm over 40 years old, and I was not especially satisfied with my employment. I had a bunch of part-time jobs, which altogether covered my bills, but I felt somewhat of a failure. After being inspired by your understanding of synchronicity, I decided to make two changes in my perspective. First of all, I started to view myself as blessed. I have a wonderful family, and I have jobs that are valuable to the world, teaching and mental health services, and I started each day with a sense of mission that I am fortunate to be doing whatever I was doing. Secondly, I started viewing the world as a place where the unexpected blessing might pop out at any moment, and even if today is not so great, tomorrow might have some unexpected surprise. Guess what? I was offered the position of principal in the high school that I was teaching in part-time. That positive energy that I put out into the universe has really resonated with the cosmos. I am stunned and still have a hard time believing that this is real. Thank you for your inspiration. Azriel." Well, Azriel, I don't know if I can take credit for that or not. Well, I will take some credit. I want to thank you for sharing this. I never know what unexpected benefits or inspiration my efforts here will produce, but it's always wonderful to hear stories such as yours. Congratulations on your positive attitude and your new job. Next, we hear from Tony, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I'm an older student working toward a bachelor's in psychology. Longtime listener of the show, I've struggled with social anxiety since I was a young kid. Forcing myself to make the leap into college was my part of my own exposure therapy. I found myself going from someone seeking help with it online to now having insight to give and a lot of people seeking my advice. I searched your site for episodes using social anxiety with and without quotes in hopes of gaining more insight and perhaps having a link to other people to listen to. Unfortunately, nothing comes up. Have you considered having anyone on the show to delve into the subject? Keep up the good work." And that's from Tony. Well, Tony, that's a good suggestion. Sounds like you might have become an expert on it yourself. I don't know if you feel like you would be a good guest yourself. Let me know. Otherwise, anyone out there can suggest an excellent guest on social anxiety, and please let me know. Next, we hear from Emma, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I found your interviews an invaluable resource since discovering them as a student several years ago. Some interviews gave me wonderful introduction to particular therapeutic approaches I've gone on to train in and use extensively in my own practice. Key example here is emotion-focused therapy interview with Leslie Greenberg. These days, I'm still really enjoying your interviews and appreciate the integrative versus reductive tone of both what you cover and how you cover it. You so often end up with conversations where the interviewee shares something real and personal about how and why they connect with their work. Many thanks to you. My donation is way overdue and the least I can offer, warmly." And that's from Emma in Melbourne, Australia. So, Emma, thanks for your very encouraging support. And finally, we hear from Jalot. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly or not, but he writes, "I'm a clinical psychologist working in Obersberg Clinic, Hornburg, Germany." Hornburg, Germany. "Will do my best to send via PayPal a standing order. You have accompanied me, unbeknown to you, in some dark hours, generously offering a humane as well as professional portal, which enriched both my patients and myself. Eternally grateful to you. Wow, I so much appreciate that that tribute. You know, sometimes I get discouraged myself, and so I thrive on this kind of feedback. It really helps me to keep on doing what I'm doing and to overcome whatever internal critical voices I am sometimes confronted by. So with that, we'll wrap it up once again. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our app or on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Kelly Flanagan, for sharing his inspirational wisdom on claiming our worthiness and lovability. Next week, my guest will be Dr. Eileen Russell, speaking about her book, Restoring Resilience, Discovering Your Client's Capacity for Healing. Dr. Russell is a practitioner of AEDP, or Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. I'm really looking forward to it. And so until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.